Hello and welcome to the TA conference teleconference Royalty Q&A moderated by Paul Rosenzweig. Paul is a certified public accountant who has worked for Harcourt Brace Jovanovich Inc. as Director of Subsidiary Accounting and served as Vice President and Treasurer of Academic Press Inc., a multinational publisher and distributor of technical books and scholarly journals. He was President of Royalty Review Service Inc., which represented authors who wanted to confirm the accuracy of their royalty statements, and as a consultant to the successor firm, Royalty Review, LLC. Rosenzweig was chairman of the Publishing and Printing Accounting Committee of the New York State Society of CPAs from 1988 to 1990, and served on the Society's Litigation Support and Publishing and Printing Committees. He is a member of the Authors Guild and serves on the Council of the Text and Academic Authors Association. This will be an open discussion. You are encouraged to ask specific questions about royalties or royalty statements, or if you sent Paul a copy of one of your royalty statements or some questions, you can ask some a specific question about that. We would like to minimize any background noises by asking all participants to press 4-star to mute themselves. And when you want to comment or ask a question, press 4-star again to speak. And then to remute yourself, you just press 4-star. Anyone have any questions about that?
This is Scott. You said you were going to record this. Will we have access to it later? We've got a very poor connection, apparently, in San Antonio.
Yes, you will. Almost immediately after the teleconference, you would have access to it. The only problem is our webmaster is out for the weekend because of the holiday. So it would be available next week. And I will send out a notice to all participants when the recording is available.
Wonderful, because we're on a cell phone and we're having a very hard time.
Yeah, I just lost the whole thing and had to come back in, Kim. This is Paul.
Okay, I don't know why we're having technical problems.
Audio here in California is just fine.
Yeah, I'm hearing fine too. Anyone else having any audio problems? I don't hear anything. So,
yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to turn the teleconference over to Paul Rosenzweig. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah, I just came back on. I had to go back on another phone. I lost you twice.
Wow.
Sorry about that. Are we there?
Yep, and I'm turning it over to you now.
Well, Kim has given you a bit of my background, and for those of you who have heard me on the subject of TAA over the number of years, basically, the problem with royalty statements is partially historic in that publishers, first of all developed their royalty statements separately. There was very little crossover between publishers. Every publisher felt they were different, and therefore they did things their way. The only general attribute of all the royalty statements is that generally they were a product of obfuscation, in that they really didn't want the authors to have as much detail as the authors might want. Over the years, that's changed somewhat. Authors have become more inquisitive, more astute, more businesslike, and are asking the questions. Some publishers have modified their statements to help. Others drag their feet even more. The other thing is that the business has changed. And as I mentioned in our pre-recorded remarks, the fact that e-materials now bypass the normal channels of distribution has complicated their royalty systems. In addition, granting rights and reprint rights have severely taxed the publisher's infrastructure in terms of being able to track, record, and grant sub-rights. Usually, up until the electronic revolution and the Kinko's revolution, if you will, publishers in those sub-rights departments dealt with other publishers and foreign translations and perhaps English language rights. But the copying thing and the extracts and the copy shops, and then, of course, the Kinko's decision, which cut down on the copy shops but shifted so much of it to the CCC, that's impacted a number of authors dramatically because there's very little information that even the publishers have about stuff like that. Okay. What other things that have complicated royalties, and I'm giving you this because I may be deflecting some questions or answering some questions that haven't yet been asked. The merger route that so many publishers have gone through, and that's complicated matters because author A has signed up with publisher one. Publisher one then sells that line of business to publisher two. Publisher two gets gobbled up by publisher three. Now the royalty statement to author A is now coming from publisher three, whose systems were built to accommodate contracts that publisher three was offering, not that publisher one offered. So as a result, they can't even cope with or know about some of the intricacies of the contracts that you signed or you were, or your attorney or agent may have negotiated. Believe me when I tell you that while there is a readability match in the product that you have authored, there is no readability match in terms of the ability of staff at the publisher to read the contracts that they've already negotiated. So we talked about the merger route, contract definitions. Again, if you are sophisticated in your negotiations or have had expert assistance from outside attorneys sophisticated in royalty publishing contracts, you've got stuff in your contracts that the publishers don't expect. And the ordinary clerk who is entering or researching or having to look up a particular transaction or series of transactions, he doesn't even bat a, he or she doesn't bat an eyelash at looking at the details in paragraph Y of your contract because they don't expect it. Okay. The general tone of what I tell authors on first contact is look at your statement, read the statement definitions of categories of sales, tie them back to your contract. If you see that that contract, that your contract doesn't refer to that category of sales, then that's the first inclination you have to call the publisher and say, I don't understand, where did this category come from? I mean, you're talking about adaptations, and we'll get to that later, the definition of adaptations anyhow. Where did that come from? I don't see that in my contract. Well, of course, what you're going to get is the equivalent of a blank stare because the publisher hasn't got a clue who did what and with which and to whom. So they're going to have to go back and research it. They're going to stall you. And you have to date your own calendar and keep follow-up. At the point, when you reach the point that you think you're being snowed or you're being ignored, then it's time to either kick the gear up higher within the publishing house or seek out professional help, be it a royalty auditor or a literary professional. And, of course, we've got both sets of those here at TAA. And the other thing is, and the very last thing I tell you is, when you're after you've done your first book and you're now negotiating your next contract, the one thing I urge you desperately, do not, under any circumstances, accept an offer of a higher advance on your next book to offset what you want as a higher royalty rate. The publisher says, well, we'll give you a higher advance. That's not the same. What you're doing is trading your own money. Okay. I guess that shuts me down in terms of my preface, if you will. I know that a couple of people have asked questions about the Bovee and Thill litigation. For those of you who don't know about it, for those who have asked, let me give you an update or an overview as I see it. Bovee and Thill are authors of management books. They used to be at McGraw-Hill, and they are now at Pearson. When they were at McGraw-Hill, they also engaged in litigation. Unfortunately, both Michael Lenny, who some of you may know as an attorney and as a member of the council at TAA, and I have had Bovee and Thill as previous clients. You will notice that neither of us are involved in the present litigation. Present litigation is against their latest publisher, which is Pearson. Now, what's rather unique about the case, and through Kim, you can get a copy of the original filing with the court, but what's very unusual is they went to sue without ever doing an audit. And the firm that they chose as their attorneys, I know that they have been on the peripheral of intellectual property, but not in publishing as many other firms have been. So their choice of this New York law firm, and it's not a major firm at all, is kind of mysterious, but we'll let that go. The case has gone nowhere. They've alleged a number of things, some of which I find very difficult to, I won't say comprehend, but things like this, they talk about foreign sales, and I'm not sure whether they're talking about foreign translations or export sales from the U.S., or for that matter, U.S. editions published by affiliates of Pearson, predominantly in third world countries. For those of you who have known about these types of things, they're called ESLs or English as a Second Language Edition or FIPIs in the old Prentice Hall things. Basically, they're international editions. ISEs, a number of publishers refer to them. And there are a lot of terms thrown around in the case that are kind of muddled. And as I said, as I indicated, the authors are litigious, so I don't think there's – and by the way, it is not a class action. It's Bovee and Thill themselves who are making this case. Now, let me switch for a moment and shut my mouth and suggest that anybody who wants to start asking questions – Let's go through the alphabetically so we can hear from people who may have questions or may have signed in late. Laura Burke, are you aboard?
Hey, Paul. Excuse me for interrupting. This is Scott. This is the Passworks, and we're going to break out. We are having a very hard time hearing, so we're going to break out of the conversation, but thank you very much for having us.
Scott, the call-in number is an 800 number if you want to try calling from your actual hotel room phone rather than a cell.
Our hotel room doesn't have a speaker phone, which is why we got on the cell phone, but that's okay. We're going to try and get the recording later, okay? So we're going to break out.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Kim, I'm having mechanical problems too, obviously.
Paul, you are?
Yeah. I'm here, but... I don't know how much of my previous thing was even picked up.
Oh, I heard
everything you said, Paul.
Okay.
I'm hearing you. Has anyone not muted themselves? That called in later after I asked.
Okay. Kim?
Yes. I'm on the conference web manager.
Yeah.
And I see that there are 9 people connected to the call.
Well, we haven't other than Scott. Let me ask a question. Should we now go through the people who are connected at the moment and ask for specific questions? And let's start alphabetically with Laura Burke.
I think that's a good idea. Laura, are you there?
You have to hit 4-star to get back on if you've muted. Laura? Well,
all right, let's move on.
Alphabetically,
Susan.
Robert, Christopherson.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a question. We, I'm very active in the sales of my books. They're the leading books in the U.S. and Canada in my field, and I have my email address in the book and so on. Under the export category in the last 2 years of my royalty statements, it has risen from 1% of my net sales to 17% last year, and on my last royalty statement, export was 27% of the sales of the main book. The publisher is unable, the editor is unable to give me a list of countries or institutions so that I can service these foreign sales. I also am not getting any email traffic as I get from U.S. and Canada sales. So I'm very suspicious about export if we have no customers or anything else, and the net book return amount has increased when with this export increase. There's a strange thing going on there. Another dimension of this is the I had a big meeting with the publisher last Sunday, and again they said they were unable at that moment to produce a list of any of the sales. When my new 7th edition came out a few weeks ago, I went to Amazon, typed in the ISBN, and the very first hits I got was a Pearson German site and a Pearson New Zealand site.
Okay.
So that's my question. The export part has risen to 27% of my sales, but I'm getting no email traffic from any market there.
Well, okay, Robert, here's the let me flip a question back to you as an active author in the marketing of your book. Have you seen any of the – you said that the Pearson sites popped up in the Amazon search.
Right.
Did you check ISBN numbers versus the ISBN of the domestic edition? In other words, is that the same edition, the same – impression, if you will, that you have from the U.S. publisher?
Yes, it was the U.S. ISBN that came up at the German and New Zealand sites.
Okay.
And there are no translations that they know of to tell me about.
Well, let me touch that one first and then come back to your original question. One of the things I try and preach to authors has always been, when you travel, be it business or personal, you have an obligation as an author to walk into a local bookstore and look for your own book, be it in the U.S. or the foreign edition. I have found, as an auditor, walking into a bookstore, I guess my classic case was walking into a bookstore in the Midlands in the U.K. and finding a U.K. edition of one of my clients' books that the publisher had never reported for, at that point, a couple of years ago, £4 something. I bought the damn book, brought it back, and effectively slapped it in front of the publisher and said, now pay the guy, because they had no record of it. So in terms of foreign editions, you have an obligation when you're traveling or when you're talking to a local colleague, I say local, foreign colleague who does contact you or you're chatting on professional things. By the way, you see my book. Can you send me a photocopy or a scan of the front cover and the back cover and the title page? You never know what you're going to find. Okay. Now back to the publisher telling you they have no record of. Robert, I have to tell you, in simplistic, and you hear both my New York voice and my New York accent when I say that's bullshit. The reality is that the publisher has those records. We call for them when we go in to do an audit, first shot, and they come spewing out. Now, when it's a sale, quote, there is no sale between the U.S. publisher and the foreign affiliate of the same publisher. That is not a sale, and that is not the basis of any royalties, do you? That is simply a transfer of inventory. What is the sale is when the foreign affiliate then sells it to local customers, be they individuals or bookstores, and that's where your royalty is generated. Those records are available. The publisher does produce them on audit. If your editor may not know that what the things are, and you've got to go back to the, maybe just tell the editor, look, those runs are available because the royalty department has them, and if you can't get them, then put me in touch with the royalty department and I'll ask for them. Obviously, the alternative, call somebody like Paul Rosenzweig, start an audit, and you're going to get the information.
Yeah.
The reason I asked about the ISBN numbers, because if there was a U.S., if there was an export edition that of your book, i.e. A FIPPIS or a ISE, what they could have done was not put or blocked off the your email address that you have in the U.S. edition, not reprinted in the export edition, and therefore that's why you're not getting any traffic. As a number of you know, I was involved for over 4 years in litigation with Pearson on a textbook case. There was big money involved, and this was also a very active author, and we saw all sorts of stuff come out of that. A foreign edition that a Pearson affiliate generated on their own, the publisher swore it didn't exist. The author handed it to the counsel of Pearson and said, here it is. What are you telling me? It doesn't exist. Wasn't that much money involved. But that's what's happening. I think all of you are aware that most publishers, and Pearson is probably the most proactive on it, are using their foreign affiliates in lieu of foreign publishers for the distribution of much of their work, so that if there's going to be a French edition of a U.S. textbook published by Pearson, it ain't going to be done by an outside house. It's going to be done by the French affiliate. Now, there are big problems on sub-rights because indications are that Pearson is playing games over there in terms of how they calculate sub-rights. That's a matter of contract interpretation. But the foreign thing, for Pearson to tell you, Robert, they don't have the records, that's malarkey.
Well, I don't believe that they can produce a list of colleges. I think
no.
27%...
That can only come from the foreign affiliate. And they will drag their feet and say, oh, that's a problem with the international department. Baloney. They can do it. You just keep pushing, you'll get it.
Yeah,
because
the foreign
affiliate has the mirror image, if you will, or in a scaled-down version, of the U.S. system. So when they sell the book to the Bangkok College in Thailand, the Thai or Southeast Asia Pearson affiliate knows where that book went. It just takes a lot of push to get them to disgorge that information.
Well, and I'm concerned that it's leaking back, and that's triggering the net book return increase because we have increased adoptions, 100% rollovers.
My experience with leaking back, they may be overstating their markets back to the U.S., and the U.S. is shipping many more books to the Southeast Asia affiliate, but that's not a sale. So that should not affect the sales records. That's merely a transfer of inventory.
And this is 27% of the sales of the book are listed as export.
Robert, I think you and I have to talk about this offline.
Okay. We're gonna formally engage you, Paul.
Okay. I don't know, Kim, who's next in the alphabetic list.
I just found out Laura Burke is back. Yeah, I am back. Sorry, I had to call back in. And I know she had some questions previous to the teleconference that she emailed you, so maybe you want to go through a couple of them.
I can go through. Again, this is Pearson questions. Laura, thank you for the batch of questions. Laura was able on her own to negotiate, in addition to recovery of royalties from Pearson, she, in addition, got 6% interest, simple interest, on the delinquencies. That's very good. We have, in the past, been charging Pearson 9% as the statutory New York State interest rate. Pearson, in recent contracts with authors who have previously gotten the 9%, have negotiated a 6% rate, simple rate. It's never compounded, and I wouldn't argue that it should be compounded. But it's certainly a heck of a lot better than a kiss on the cheek and gee, we're sorry. Now, as far as international custom works, which you've also questioned, when they say they have no record of it, you know, that's malarkey. Particularly when part of it has been reported on the royalty statement. Custom publishing was the publisher's answer to the Kinko's type and copy shops type course packs. And that is the publisher steps in and makes the deal with a professor or a department, domestically anyhow, to put out a book that may have 20 pages from your book and 30 pages from another author's book and 50 pages of perhaps department-supplied information. And the deal is supposed to be that you get a pro rata share of the selling price divided by the content of your book as a numerator over the total number of pages or total content of the book as the denominator, and that the records are not at hand in every case, that's pretty usual. If custom publishing is already a major factor in your royalty statement, then I think, as I said to Robert Christofferson, then you've got to push a little harder and say, come on, guys, this is too big a number for you not to have records.
Well, the question about the records had to do with international custom. They acknowledged the domestic custom, and they paid the back. They had paid too little a royalty on it. It was a situation very much like the lawsuit that you referred to in that they had applied this abridgment rate to me, which they really couldn't do.
Yeah.
And so I have worked with professionals on the contracts, and so things were pretty crystal clear there. But the international custom, they claim they had no records of it, but they have to ask me for permission for certain kinds of custom. So I had records that there were international custom sales. So now they say they're looking for them, and I may hear from them.
Okay. Let me add something here. It's really not the publisher's fault. Foreign subsidiary, having been vice president and treasurer of Academic Press, which was at that time the largest international scientific publisher, far outstripping Blackwell's or who the monster is now. But anyhow, what we found was that foreign affiliates, they want to hide the deck of cards because they don't want the parent company getting the money from them for the true measure of what's going on. So if they can hide a transaction from the domestic parent, they're just going to keep the funds in their own country. And if they've got a profit sharing arrangement, that's just going to fatten it up. The U.S. publishers have an obligation to their stockholders to cut that down, but it's not an area that their own internal audit people are addressing. We went after it when we found it when I was at Academic Press. We also do it from the royalty standpoint in going after them and saying, wait a minute, you sent that. I mean, as an example, routine audit, as I explained to Robert, where you've got books being shipped from the U.S. publisher to the foreign publisher, to the foreign affiliate, that's not a sale. But we see the record that they sent them 2,000 books. All of a sudden, we're looking at the sales records coming back, and they say they only sold 100 books. Really? Where are the other 1,900 books? Oh, yeah, we forgot that entry. Or, oh, they didn't tell us about that. You mean you didn't notice that for 2 years, your Philippine subsidiary did not report back any sales on these titles? Come on. That's sloppy. But then again, publishers are renowned for being sloppy. I'm fascinated by international custom publishing because I truly have not seen very much activity in that over the years. And for you to have records of being asked for permissions, it may very well be that what was being, that unless you have documents that specifically relate to international custom publishing, what they were asking permission for was to grant somebody else permission to either translate or use your material, and that's a no-no. That should only be done from the U.S. parent. So it will be interesting, and I'd love to hear the results of that follow-up.
Well, they have to – these are real international custom works. If, for example, somebody in Australia taking a few chapters of the book and or the company over there, the Australian arm of the company, and combining that with some other material. Because for those combinations, they – in my particular case, they do have to ask about it. So what is happening is that the editor seems to be catching those and saying, oh, we have to ask her about that type of custom. I don't have any records, and I think the largest number of customs are ones where they might say with a particular book, I only want chapters 1 to 6. I don't want anything else. But I have no records of that type of custom personally.
Laura, for interrupting, you may not have heard this. You may have been off at the time. Have any colleagues in Australia?
Yes, I do.
Well, they're the people you should be talking to because you may ask them, hey, have you seen my material or have you seen a book containing my material or a course pack or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, keep the pressure up on the publisher. but use your professional affiliations to track down. I mean, I've had clients who know about foreign translations by the publisher, authorized by the publisher, because they get an inquiry from a professor in a foreign country saying, gee, I've got the, you know, Spanish edition of your book. And the author is saying, what Spanish edition? I don't know anything about a Spanish edition. He doesn't tell that to, but he just eventually gets at least a Xerox copy or a scan of the cover, the back cover, and the copyright page. Yeah. So that he then picks up the phone and says to the publisher, hey, what's going on? Where's that money? And I strongly urge you to use your professional network, and particularly you hear about something in a particular area, whether it's Australia. Australia covers for some publishers Australia, New Zealand. Some of them, it's even Southeast Asia. Just mm-hmm. spread the net out because it's your money.
Right, but of course, our books are being distributed all over the world. So I may know somebody in Australia. I don't know anybody in Croatia. I have a Croatian translation, so it's impossible.
Don't look for a lot of money from a Pardon Croatian me? Translation, even if it was Harry Potter. Okay.
Pardon me.
I said even if it was Harry Potter, don't look for a lot of money in royalties on a Croatian translation.
Well, I won't, but at any rate, it sounds as if tracking all this down is impossible. Am I correct?
No, it's not. I know of authors both in text and trade publishing who do it quite well, again, usually with their professional network, and not full-time, because obviously they have many other interests in addition to teaching. Those are still teaching, but they track it down and they keep copies of every they when they find out about a translation, they make sure they get a copy of it, so they have it on their bookshelf or in a reserve area that they can look for. Publishers are being sloppy, and it's your money, and relying on the publisher without pressuring them to come up with the answers, that's a dangerous precedent. The other thing you raised was about CCC. CCC came to life after the Kinko's decision, which cut down on bucket shop copying without payment. And unfortunately, the publishers have no ability to do what the CCC is doing for them. And basically, the CCC gets a right from the publisher to copy up to X percent of a particular title. They do that, they grant the right, they get the money, they remit to the publisher, and the publisher is supposedly remitting one half back to you. That the information that comes through on your royalty statement is either meaningless or close to gibberish, that's really a function of just the volume of stuff that the CCC is generating. And it's commingled with, 200 or 500 other titles, and that they're snatching some of the information and getting it straight. I don't expect a heck of a lot more. The CCC.
So I should ignore that.
Huh?
In other words, it looks so strange. 1,140 copies of something with a net revenue of $7.53.
Well, that's kind of nuts, because $7.53, just back it up. If the publisher is taking half, that meant that the whole transaction was $15.
The whole transaction was $7.53. Half of that went to me.
Wow. Oh, that was the gross price?
And I think I might have gotten a percentage of it. Yeah, that's net. That's what they said net was, $7.
Well, I think you've got to, for that one alone, you can go back to the publisher and say, wait a minute, guys, what's your deal with CCC? How could that be a reasonable royalty? Unless it was 1,000 copies of a page and a half.
Well, who knows? Yeah.
But, you can go back to them and say, wait a minute, what's going on? And just push on that one and get a feel for what it is. The CCC certainly does not have the right to have somebody reprint an entire book. That's not available to the CCC. So when I said a page, I may have been very minimal. Maybe it was 3 pages. Well, even 3 pages, 1,000 copies, I don't know what that's worth.
Well, you couldn't get that much paper for $7.53, I don't think. So it looked very strange to me. So CCC stands for the Copyright Clearance Center. Oh, okay.
And that's where professors and college bookstores turn to for permissions to do course packs. And
right.
Sometimes an author looking, an academic author looking to incorporate some information rather than go to the publisher for permission, will go to the CCC. Again, I'm not privy to what the actual contracts are between the CCC and the publishers, but, you can get that information from them, from the publisher.
Okay.
Just to affirm, Laura, I have exactly the same problem with the abridgment business and with these extremely low nets on the export portion of the sales, where
the book
domestically nets at 80 and export the book is netting at 21 or 25.
Right. My issue there is that they seem to be contracting with themselves for things like translations at a very low rights fee, and they give you half of it, and then I think they just sell the book.
Wow.
So because you can see on the royalty statement that it's Pearson South America with the Spanish translation.
That's a no-no, because now you got to go back to your contract.
Uh-huh.
See, what your contract, classic Prentice Hall Pearson contracts, talk about third-party translations.
Right.
I have never seen a Pearson contract that talked about in-house translations. There are in-house provisions for other things, but in-house translations were never contemplated. What may be happening, and we've caught this, is that they have decided, well, that's the same as, nah. And that may require the heavy hand of an attorney to slap them down and say, no, guys, that's not going to happen. So the base point goes back to your contract or contracts, and go read that clause very carefully. If you hired a professional to help you negotiate that contract, go back to that professional and say, hey, wait a minute. Look what they're doing. This is not what was intended, was it? And start the chain there. Because that's self-dealing. And I did a piece for TAA a number of years ago called Who is the Publisher? Because when a publisher ships a book to its affiliate and then sells it at a, quote, sells it at a discount, and then the affiliate then... and that becomes the basis of the sale, that's malarkey. That's not the way it works.
Uh-huh.
You get your percentage on what the affiliate sells it for, and nothing in between. And there's no splitting. So
okay.
They're playing games along that. Again, back to your contract, and if an outside professional thinks an audit is required first, well, then they go that route. I would certainly not recommend going to suit without an audit.
Oh, yeah.
But,
but you are recommending that if I can't solve it with them independently, and I have a channel of communication. It's a very slow channel, and it's clear that they're not enjoying this, okay? But if I can't get them to straighten this out, then the first place you're saying is an expert attorney.
Well, if the attorney helped you prepare the contract.
Right.
Because he's got his own, he or she has their own records of what the discussions were and what the intent was. And if it's somebody, hopefully, that has a background in book publishing contracts, they know darn well what the difference is in third party versus self-dealing translations. And as I said, if it's Pearson, I know the Pearson contract, and there is no provision for third party, for in-house translations.
Right.
It's just not in the contract, but never contemplated.
And Paul, this is Kim Pollack. How long should you wait when you're having an issue like this from the time that you bring it to the publisher's attention to the time that you bring in a third party to assist you, if that's an auditor or an attorney?
It's a matter of when you feel you're being stonewalled. If it's a matter of time and you call them in February, as an example, or in March, they're churning out, they're getting the royalty statements for December 31 ready to go April 1st. So that's the prime thing, and it's going to wait until after April 1st. So by May 15th, if you still don't have an answer and you come back to them and you truly feel you're being stonewalled, that's the time to drop the other shoe.
Okay.
It's not a matter of, you know, if you start in April, late April, then, you know, then it should only be the number of weeks. But having said that, I can tell you that we're still trying to wrap up an audit with a publisher that started in 2004. So,
okay.
Things move very slowly.
Okay.
I guess the next name on our list alphabetically was Susan Fawcett. I don't know if Susan signed on.
I don't think she did. I think she was one of the ones that didn't sign on. And the next
Otto
one would be
Fierro, I believe, also didn't sign on.
Yeah, he did. Is he?
Oh, he did.
Are you still here? You have to press 4-star to unmute yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I don't have any questions. I just wanted to listen to it. I'm hoping to, you know, eventually sign a contract with a publisher. So this is informative for me. So I'm just listening.
Okay.
Well, it's good to get this information prior to signing a contract.
Right, right. Now, would you, you know how, well, I guess I could have a question. So they usually give you a certain percent, like, say, 15% for domestic sales and then 5% for foreign sales. Would publishers generally give both if you insist on the same percentage for both?
Did they
give you 5% for foreign sales?
Ricardo, I'm sorry.
No problem.
I have one client, and only one client, who has a uniform rate across the board for all channels of distribution. For all channels of distribution. He's a very prolific author. He's got an awful lot of clout, and he's the only one that has ever negotiated that across the board single uniform rate. Publishers don't like it because their argument is that they have a lower gross margin on such sales.
Whoever's phone is ringing, could you please mute
yourself?
Yeah,
I'm trying to get rid of it. Hold on.
This is Robert Christofferson. I've had Canada at the domestic rate since the beginning.
That's interesting. Yeah.
They claim that they've got lower margins. I've got to tell you that direct sales, that's baloney. There's no reason for lower sales. And for that matter, now with export, they're passing along the shipping charges, so why should that be at a lower margin? Canada, any negotiator with a publisher will argue that Canada and the U.S. is one market,
mm-hmm.
and it's got to be at the domestic rate, and you cannot use Canada as an export rate.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that answers your question, Ricardo.
Well, I actually had a contract with a publisher before that I terminated because of so many problems, but there was a 15% for domestic and 5% for foreign. And I thought, wow, I mean, in retrospect.
They screwed you on that one.
Yeah, so I wouldn't do that again on the next contract, but I'm assuming I'm being presumptuous. But, I mean, what seems reasonable, 10% and 15% to push hard for?
Well, obviously to push for the same rate that you get on U.S.
Yeah.
But
okay.
If you're going to take a step back, I think Pearson routinely goes 10% on export if they can hold the line.
Okay. So would 10% and 15% be, you know, reasonable? I mean, would you consider that successful negotiation if you acquire those concessions?
It depends on the course material also. I mean, heavy scientific usually pulls a higher rate than social sciences.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been the rule of the game.
Okay.
Again, this goes back to all publishing costs and things like that, which no longer play, you know, typesetting and things like that. That's all like electronic now. So,
mm-hmm.
I a professional will tell you that there is no, what shall I say?
Standard?
No standard. And when a publisher tells you, oh, this is our standard contract, you say, yeah, right. And, you know, the
okay.
blue is blue, but so what?
While we're on that subject, I encourage any of you that want some more information about negotiating a contract or a standard contract to participate in the April 25th teleconference with authoring attorney Stephen Gillen. He's going to talk about publisher standard contracts and terms you can and should negotiate. And you can get more information from me following this teleconference.
Okay. The next name I had alphabetically was Barbara Murphy. Barbara, are you there?
Hi,
what's
how are you?
I
have no questions. I'm just enjoying listening and learning a great deal just listening. I have a contract with five books with McGraw-Hill, and McGraw-Hill is its own worst enemy sometimes, and I guess my worst enemy. But I'm learning a great deal listening to you, and if I have any specific questions or problems, I'm certain I'm going to be calling on you to become my representative.
Well, let me offer something gratuitously.
Yes.
You got a problem with your McGraw-Hill contracts because McGraw-Hill routinely never had, quote, an audit clause in their contracts, and for the last 5 years has adamantly refused to allow any audits where there was no audit clause negotiated in advance.
Uh-huh.
We try to get the Authors Guild, because it started with a trade contract, we try to get the Authors Guild to pressure McGraw-Hill. They tried up to a point and then just dropped the ball, and the then counsel of the Authors Guild left, and they just threw up their hands and have done nothing about it. So I can help, I can talk to you, I can counsel you, but unless you negotiate in your new contract and a specific audit clause, you've got a rough time getting McGraw-Hill to cough up additional money.
Okay, thank you, Paul. I appreciate
okay.
that.
I believe the Passwalks have signed off. Or are they back?
Yes, they signed off. They couldn't get a good connection.
Okay. Next name alphabetically I've got is Judy Rasminski. Judy, are you on?
Yes, I'm still here, but I have no specific questions either. I also am listening with great interest, and I'm learning a great deal. But in fact, I actually at this point have to sign off because I have other things I must do. I have another commitment. Thank you so much for your help. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you.
The last one I had was Barbara Waxer. Barbara, four-star, are you there?
And I am here.
And any questions?
I have two quick ones. One is just a follow-up on the Canada, foreign, and just any other category to which my publisher, which is Cengage, likes to cut. And does that, is the profit margin the same argument given for high school sales if you're predominantly a higher ed market, but they do also sell to high school?
Oh, that is not the publisher. There is no, in fact, it's probably a higher margin because with the high school market, there is no middleman. In other words, they don't, a bookstore, high schools are buying direct from the publisher, the entire El High market. If a book is selling in the El High market, publisher is selling direct. So they may be selling at a higher net price than what they're getting by selling to a Barnes & Noble.
Good to know.
There is no justification for a lower rate. Yes, it is standard for publishers to try and get you to take a higher rate. I have to tell you that unlike the author client that I mentioned before, I have seen El High as the same rate in many more contracts with authors of lesser clout. But publishers will always try to get a lower rate on El High without any real justification.
And apparently Cengage has been quite successful in that. My second question has to do with when my publisher is choosing not to print a new edition. And as you know, I write software. This actually is about the copyright books. And am I correct in my inclination to not try to negotiate for the rights to the current book and simply negotiate a new contract for trade, not academic, with a new publisher?
I don't have a law degree. That's an answer. That's a question for a Michael Lenny, a Steve Gillen. I can give you a dozen, half a dozen certainly, attorneys who negotiate literary. That's a legal question. I won't even go near it.
Okay.
Anybody else? Second thoughts? Second questions?
One thing that you'll run into that, you know, you insert
Robert,
Canada on the domestic line. This is Robert. And the publisher will exercise a derivative clause to produce a Canadian version of the book at reduced author input. And the author should wade into that, head it off, get it at the U.S. rate, and be engaged in authoring or collaborating on their own book in the foreign country. We've had the experience where Pearson was going to take over my book, which was already 70% of the market in Canada, and produce a Canadian book and reduce my royalty. And I fought them and won, and I get to be the author of my own book. So the Canada approach, once you get it domestic, watch out for the derivative exercise.
I have the same experience. This is Laura. Actually do the Canadian edition myself.
Yes.
So, but you don't want that to happen in part because you may find that you don't like the book that they produce under your name.
Yeah.
That was my problem.
Kim, if I wanted to talk to Laura after we got off the phone, can I give her my number or your number? Or what do we do?
Well, Laura, if you don't mind my putting you in touch with Robert, I can do that via email after the call.
Sure.
Okay. If nobody has any other questions, we can close out the teleconference.
Well, Kim, could Paul just a real quick 1, 2, 3? What we need to prepare to engage him?
Oh, Kim, is that okay to talk on the conference?
Go ahead.
All right.
Kim, I'm going to say goodbye. This is Barbara Murphy. Thank you so very much to you and to Paul.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara.
Robert?
Yeah.
Okay. What we look for is the copies of the contracts and copies of the most recent 3 years' sales. You know, the royalty statements.
Royalty statements.
Once we have that, we do an absolutely no-charge smell test. Don't bother the publisher. We're working with your documents and your documents only. Obviously, if you've gotten some stuff from the publisher on the side, well, that's fine, too. If it flunks the smell test, then we sit down, we negotiate a contract with you, and until that contract is signed, publisher hasn't got a clue that we're talking. Once we've signed the contract, it is totally contingent fee. If we don't collect anything, it costs you nothing. The contingent fee basis is one-third, and there are no add-ons. We don't even have to travel to the publisher, and certainly with Pearson. Pearson doesn't want us on the premises. They'll ship everything, boxes and boxes of stuff. Now, what we follow up with the publisher immediately with the notification that we're on the case is we have a shopping list of items that we're going to ask them for, including those reports that you heard they say they don't have any record of. Baloney. They know where those reports are, and they come out very quickly. The reports come quickly. The after negotiations take forever. I urge you never to engage us or anyone like us when you are about to sign a new book or negotiating a new contract. Get that out of the way first. You don't want the noise of the audit impacting your negotiations. Other than that, that's all it takes. And if it doesn't flunk the smell test, we either shred the stuff you sent us or ship it back to you because we have no need for it. So, and that's the whole thing. The contract doesn't come until after the smell test.
And you want all the subsequent addendums?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. We want the whole ball of wax. Yeah, it's going to run either your copy or your Kinko's store a bit, but the surefire way of doing it. Obviously, if you got it electronic, that's easier, but... Yeah, and no, we've never been able to get a publisher to provide the information that we're looking for electronically. They all want to print it out. So that's just more paper, more trees being chopped up.
Yeah.
We can help that.
So were you saying that if you're planning or are in the process of negotiating a contract,
don't
make a big deal about the ability or need to audit or something
right.
like
don't
that. Just go ahead and accept what they write.
In your contract, make sure that you've got an audit clause.
Okay.
And one further bit of advice, since you've raised it, it is not unusual for the audit clause to specify that in the event that the audit turns up a shortage of more than 5% of the period being audited, that they pay the audit fee. So that if it turns out that there is big bucks involved, you get it free and clear, because then the publisher ends up paying the audit fee. And
okay.
I've got one client that's been using my services now for, I don't know, 10 years, and I think he's paid us 1 or 2 years. Every other year, publisher pays.
What is the clause again that you're recommending there?
It's an audit clause, number one, and certainly if you give me your email address, I can send you a sample of an audit clause that covers the audit fee if it's above 5%.
That'd be great, Paul. If you want to send that to me, this is Kim.
Okay.
I will distribute that and Paul's contact information to all the participants if you're interested in talking with Paul further about your own contracts and royalties.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.